Morning all. All right, good to go. So, baptism, where to start? As Andrew said, it's an important topic, it's a big topic, and yet I'll start by saying something I started with last time I was up here, is that you'll get what I've been given. There's nothing more that I can give. This topic about baptism has a lot of, shall we say, baggage, a lot of connotations, a lot of expectations, a lot of history behind it. But today, as I said, you get what I've been given as I've been preparing for today. And yes, I've got a lot of slides, so you can look up there. So I'll start by covering what I'm going to cover, which is largely three areas. Water as a symbol, some Hebrew word stuff, and Jesus' baptism, obviously. The first thought that popped into my head might be a bit strange, and maybe it's just my weird head, but the first thought that popped into my head was this quote. Does anybody know who said this? Correct. Thank you, Bruce Lee. Give that man a lolly. I don't have one, so someone else can give me one. I don't really know why it popped into my head, but it did start me thinking. Obviously, it's a water quote, but it did start me thinking down that whole process. Bruce was using water in this particular analogy to basically encourage martial artists to not stick to rigid forms, but to flow, to be adaptive. He was the world's first mixed martial artist, so to speak. And the full quote says, "You must be shapeless, formless, like water. Put water in a cup, it becomes a cup. When you put it in a bottle, it becomes a bottle. Put it in a teapot, it becomes a teapot. The water can flow or it can crash." So this quote, this started me down a process of looking at water as a symbol, as a thing that throughout time and space and history, people have spoken about, people have used as a symbol to evoke images. And poets, songwriters, artists, they've used water in that way forever and a day, and will continue to do so. As a substance, we use water. In our day-to-day lives, we drink it, we cook with it, we wash in it, we play in it. We even go as far as searching other planets for the sign of water as an indication of life. And that alone is a fairly significant image for us to use to understand that water is a reflection of life, is something that where there is water, there is life. But we also, water, we value it, but we also take it for granted. It's a humble thing, but it's also powerful. Water, if you allow water to flow over rocks for hundreds of years, it will slowly erode that rock away. If you allow it to penetrate cracks in the rock and it freezes, it will shatter the rock. It has power and carries power with it. So it's subtle and yet powerful. And even in the Bible, water is used in many, many ways. The word water alone appears in the Bible more than the words faith, hope, or prayer. So it's more prevalent in the Bible throughout as a word, as an analogy, as a something to evoke an image, to describe people, to describe the living waters that flow from the Lord. All of this sort of imagery. It also appears at the beginning and the end of the Bible, and as I said, fairly consistently in between. The earth began immersed in water in Genesis 1:2, prior to the world water being separated from dry ground. The earth was unformed and void, darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the surface of the water. So even in the second verse of the Bible, we have water introduced. The earth was cleansed with water at the time of Noah, and is spoken about in the last few verses of Revelation. The Spirit and the Bride say, "Come, Let anyone who hears this say, come. Let anyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who desires drink freely from the water of life. So right at the end of the Bible, we still have water used and water spoken about. It's a significant image. And today I'd like you to remember the visuals, remember the images, not the words so much, but the images that they evoke, the symbolism, the rather than my words, the pictures that enter in your head as far as what I'm going to be talking about. I want us to focus less on the mechanics and I guess the baggage and the history and the expectations around baptism as such, and go back to trying to provide some input and insight into what baptism itself as an act carries with it, the history behind it, the power of it, the significance of it, less, so to speak, than the mechanics, if that makes sense. So, some Hebrew stuff. If you search the word baptism in the Bible, it only technically appears in the New Testament. The Old Testament word is immersion, because that's exactly what baptism translates into, is the word immersion. So, baptism is not that. In the Old Testament, the word immersion is often attributed to ritual cleansing or washing. It was also apparently common after returning from the market, before eating. It was something that was commonplace. In Jewish tradition, there were different classifications for where the ritual washing could be performed. So obviously separate from the washing as you come back home after the market, but the ritual washing and cleansing before you enter the temple. But the classifications range from the least desirable being water pits or cisterns up to purpose-built ritual baths called mikveh. Now, if I'm pronouncing it wrong, you can tell me later because I'm just guessing here, but mikveh. But the best possible location was in living waters, which were referred to as natural rivers or lakes. So that was the epitome. That was, if you had that available, you would go with that. If you didn't, there was lesser classifications, if you like, to say, yep, okay, that's acceptable in this way. But it's interesting that the mikveh, so this is the purpose-built baths, were used to cleanse oneself before entering the temple, and they were also found in people's homes. So again, it was commonplace, it was known, it was recognised, these things existed. And the design of them usually had, or in many cases had, steps going down one side, the water in the middle, and steps on the other side. So you would enter from one side, immerse, and leave from the other. So if you get the image, entering dirty, washing, immersing, and entering and leaving clean. The Hebrew language is amazing. I wish I could read it, I can't. I've heard it referred to as God's love language, because it's so very expressive. It has so much weight behind it. The deeper you dig, the more that can be revealed from a word study, the more that can be seen, the more significance. So this next bit I found really exciting, and you're just going to come along for the ride. So the word mikveh, as I said, this is the ritual bath, the purpose-built bath, shares the same root as the word for hope, line, and alignment. Hope, line, and alignment. So you see already the converging of ideas here. This purpose-built bath carries with it, historically, from the word that's used to describe it, these ideas and these concepts and these thoughts. And if I stopped here, we could consider all of these images and their significance, because I don't believe for a second that it's by accident that these connotations, these visuals, are relevant and pertinent to the word that's used to describe the place where this immersion would occur. But the real interesting bit comes from the same root word as another word, which I'm not going to describe, try to say, but its definition. Bind together, gather together, or wait upon. these sort of ideas. You can see them all up there. Bind together, gather together, or wait upon. So can you see the significance? Can you see the image and the visuals that just the word alone is drawing into and carrying weight into this act that we practice still today as a way of following through on what our Lord has done for us and by remembering him? The Jewish people practiced ritual washing immersion in this thing called the mikvah. It carries with it a number of ideas based on its use, based on the Hebrew language: hope, alignment, line and alignment, waiting on God. And the root word binding, when you look a little bit further, it refers to it there. It says perhaps by twisting, as in, and one of the readings that I read, it talked about the twisting of yarn together. So the binding of yarn, the actual tying together of that, those threads into a single, cohesive, useful piece of rope. It's all imagery. It's all carries weight in the words and in the understanding of these historical things that were used for the purposes of immersion. So if we look at this in the context of baptism, could we consider these words and images as also being attributed to a significant act of, shall we say, spiritual obedience? Aligning oneself to God, binding that person to his word, his laws, and his righteousness, and waiting on and putting our hope in God. Can you visualize them? Can you see them? Can you see the alignment and the bond that they carry with it? Now, it doesn't stop there, because in Jeremiah 17, verse 13, it says, O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who turn away from you will be disgraced. They will be buried in the dust of the earth, for they have abandoned the Lord, the fountain of living water. So again, living water, a reference to water, and the Lord being the source of it. Now, the interesting bit is the word that is used in this verse, which we translate into hope, the hope of Israel, is actually mikvah. So it's a water analogy. The Lord is the fountain of living water. Those who turn away will dry out. It seems to make sense when you put it all together, the way that it's being spoken about, buried in the dust of the earth. It all makes sense when you look at the original word and recognize the weight that that carries with it. As well as just the word for hope, there is this additional definition. There is this additional weight behind it. Hope, alignment, waiting and hoping on God, binding or being bound to the source of living water. Remember, the word we're talking about is the purpose-built bath, a humble but a significant word and a significant bath, a significant place for the people, particularly in the Old Testament. So the third point, Jesus' baptism. And there are, obviously, you'd spend a long time talking about this, and there are a number of significant things that stand out for me about Jesus' baptism, but I'll try and flick through them quickly because there's really just one that I want to focus on. So to start with, he chose John, who was related to Jesus, possibly his cousin, but he chose family to be there. That stood out for me. He was willing to be baptized by a man. Now, if you think of Jesus not effectively needing to be cleansed, purified in the way that the Old Testament people, the Israelites, would have needed to be before they entered the temple, all that kind of stuff. John was just a man, a righteous man of God, but still a man. The classification of water isn't really spoken about. It's the Jordan River. So yes, it's that sort of highest classification of living water, but it's just a place. It was the act that was significant, not the water itself. But the bit that stood out for me, above all others, was that God was watching. And it makes sense that God would watch his only son, that he would be watching him constantly. But we know that he was watching this particular event because he spoke. This specific situation, in this specific scene, God of heaven chose this moment to speak about his son. He said, "You are my beloved son, in you I am well pleased." God chose this moment to look on his son and to acknowledge him. So why did Jesus choose to be baptized? Well, in the story of Matthew, Jesus goes to John, possibly his brother, sorry, his cousin. He goes to him, he says, "I want you to baptize me." Jesus sought John out. He actually had to go to where John was located. He said, "Baptize me." John argues and says, no, it should be the other way around. You should baptize me, shouldn't baptize you." But as it says in Matthew 3:15, Jesus says, "It should be done, for we must carry out all that God requires." The next reference that I've got there, the other translation is often, this wording is often used also, "For thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness." To fulfill all righteousness. So we refer to baptism and we talk about it and describe it as a representation of Jesus' death, burial and resurrection. So if you remember the mikvah, the usual structure, entering one side, immersing and leaving out the other. Jesus' baptism was a path that we can follow because his crucifixion was a path that we don't need to because he paid the price for us. But his baptism is a path that we can follow. So let's take a slight detour. As I was thinking about baptism, there was this weird analogy that kept coming back to me and it wouldn't go away. And it's, bear with me, because I don't think I've ever actually heard anybody else use this analogy. Baptism and a wedding ceremony. The act of choosing life, of accepting Christ, can be a solitary one. You can have somebody who prays on their own, in the quiet of a room, whatever situation they're in, accept Christ. That event can occur from a human perspective as one person. Now, let's forget about, put aside the fact that the Holy Spirit would be there, the spiritual world would be abuzz at the time of someone's conversion, but from a human perspective, it can be a solitary event. Baptism cannot. So even in the Old Testament, even in the case of the mikvah, the pool, the immersion pools before entering the temple, there would have been people around. It would have been a sight to be seen to ensure that the cleansing has been performed, that people had actually gone through that event. So we come to a guy and a girl making a choice to be joined in marriage. They're often the only two people present. Not always, but often. It's the marriage ceremony which is seen by others. It's the display of their commitment. So if you put aside for a fact that some people don't follow through on the engagement, the choice made, the accepting of that initial ring, that choice for commitment of bonding two people together, that's significant in its own right as a commitment to each other. The wedding ceremony is the validation, the display for all to see that the words spoken have translated into action. So if we recap, water is a humble thing. God created it, gives it freely. It's subtle and yet powerful. And it's significant as a visual throughout the Bible and throughout all known history. The Hebrew mikvah gives us an amazing visual reference, evokes a whole range of additional thoughts and images, and carries weight and power in that word of hope, binding, alignment, of living water. It's used in Jeremiah as a way to impart an image of the Lord as being the hope of Israel. And at Jesus' baptism, God was watching. Baptism, the act itself, is humble. It's an act of trust, of faith, of hope. We could say that it's an act to show alignment or binding. Baptism is the validation, the display for all to see that the words spoken have translated into action. So why baptism? Because God is watching his people. And that image from Matthew sticks with me and stuck with me all the way throughout. It, God watching. He chose that moment to speak. In 1 Peter 2:24, it says, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that free from sins, we might live for righteousness." To live for that which Jesus fulfilled. To show that the righteousness that Christ fulfilled will be lived out in us. So what do I see when I see someone being baptized? As I was thinking about this, I put myself back in a scene of watching somebody there being baptized, and the thought that came to my mind was the joy of the people who were present. That was the thought that came to mind. Watching somebody in the water with fellow believers, with friends, family, other fellow believers around, watching that act of obedience, acknowledging that person, acknowledging their faith and their commitment to the God that they are following. As they rise from the water, I thought of the joy expressed on the faces of all the believers present as someone takes another step in faith, as they see the physical display of the inner change. So if I look back now at what I've been saying for the last however long, the visuals of the mikvah, of the meaning of the word and all that it symbolizes, the weight of history that is carried with it, for me, that imagery of hope, of bond, and of alignment, to me, that carries more weight than it did before. To show that the righteousness that Christ fulfilled will be lived out in us. Thank you.